Welcome to Session 8 in the Biblical Doctrines of Civil Government. The topic is civil disobedience. And the first text that comes to the mind of every Christian is Peter's response to the Sanhedrin when they commanded the apostles to no longer preach the message of Christ. Acts chapter 4, verse 18. And when they had summoned them, they commanded them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John answered and said to them, "Whether it is right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God, you be the judge." In Acts 5, the apostles were then imprisoned for preaching the gospel. And again, standing before the council, Peter and the apostles answered, "We must obey God rather than men." So we see in these texts the mandate and the pattern for civil disobedience. The state does not have full authority, but is subordinate to God's authority. In a sense, a Christian is not breaking the law. The Christian is obeying a higher law. And a helpful illustration would be in the military. If a sergeant tells you to sweep out the barracks, but as you're going, a 5-star general comes along and asks you to assist him moving packages, you're not disobeying orders. The orders of the lower officer are being overridden by the orders of the higher officer. So the example in Acts seems to be quite straightforward and simple, but in practical application, it opens the door to all sorts of questions. If the state confiscates our Bibles, should we give over our Bibles or hide our Bibles? What if the state is confiscating guns? Should we hand over our guns or practice civil disobedience because of Second Amendment rights? And what are we to think of Thomas Jefferson's statement, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants"? Which liberties should we fight for? Or Patrick Henry's statement, "Give me liberty or give me death"? Which liberties should we be willing to die for? To drive without seatbelts? To be able to vote? To be able to evangelize in public places? Was Dietrich Bonhoeffer right in joining a plot to assassinate Hitler? Was John Brown, the 1860s abolitionist, justified in raiding the armory at Harper's Ferry? What if the state asked Christians to not attend church during a time of plague? Or what if the state asked Christians to wear a mask in church to prevent the spread of disease? Now all of a sudden, Acts chapter 5 doesn't seem so easily applied. About 10 years ago, I did a series of 5 radio programs on the subject of civil disobedience, and I was barely scratching the surface. So as a first point in this doctrine, realize the vastness of this subject. And realize there must be a discernment of general biblical principles and a leading of the Spirit, because the Bible doesn't give us specific answers to every question. We're to have our senses trained to discern good and evil, Hebrews 5, and Ephesians 5, "Be not unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is." And some of the issues involved in civil disobedience are matters of Christian liberty and deference. Good Christians can disagree. Romans 14, "There are different measures of faith, and whatever is not of faith is sin." And other issues are non-negotiable. But some professing Christians will be deceived by the world to assume that the non-negotiables are merely matters of Christian liberty, as if Daniel could have opted not to open his window and pray in defiance of the king's command. Furthermore, as we consider this doctrine, recognize that the church will need to know the doctrine of civil disobedience well in preparation for coming days, the evil day, as it's described in Ephesians chapter 6, "so that you may be able to stand or resist in the evil day when Christianity is out of season," 2 Timothy chapter 4. Biblical civil disobedience involves 2 aspects. First, personal civil disobedience of the individual Christian. Second, civil disobedience of magistrates, which is often called the doctrine of lower magistrates or lesser magistrates. As we see in the case of the Old Testament judges, men called of God to challenge the authority of ruling magistrates. This week, we'll discuss personal civil disobedience. Next week, magisterial civil disobedience. And to organize this material, let's break it down into a list of biblical principles or guidelines. First, we must discern the laws of God that are non-negotiable. Which state laws call for the practice of civil disobedience? In Acts chapter 5, the apostles were compelled to obey a major command of the Christian faith, the Great Commission, the preaching of the gospel. It wasn't civil disobedience over some minor point of personal religious conviction or just some inconvenience. We recognize that there is a hierarchy of God's law. There are the weightier matters of the law. Although the Pharisees failed in their discernment in this regard, we must and can discern the difference. Although it was very troublesome and seemed to interfere with God's plan for the birth of the Messiah, Mary and Joseph still traveled to Bethlehem to pay the tax. They obeyed the state. Jesus said to the disciples, "Lest we offend them, pay the tax." And when the Samaritans wouldn't let Jesus come through their region, Jesus didn't force his way into Samaria. He went around. Many requirements of the state can be tangentially linked to a scriptural violation, so that one could justify civil disobedience at every turn. I mean, someone could claim, "I don't believe it's the state's right to take care of our health care because Jesus is our healer. Therefore, I'll practice civil disobedience in regard to health insurance requirements." Or someone might say, "I don't believe it's the government's job to take care of our retirement, and hence I'll practice civil disobedience in regard to Social Security." The state may pass laws that interfere with God's plan for marriage, child rearing, property rights, but we're to defer to the state as much as possible and find a workaround. For example, in order for churches in America to be tax exempt, they must apply to be a 501c3 organization. However, some Christians believe that to stand on principle, a church must never sign up to be a 501c3 because this is the state requiring a license to practice Christianity. However, there is nothing directly unbiblical about the state putting some licensing requirement on the church in regard to financial accountability, as long as the state is not prohibiting or limiting the preaching of God's truth. If that's the case, the church is to practice civil disobedience, meeting in fields, in basements, smuggling Bibles. Now, some of these state requirements may lead to unbiblical state restrictions on Christian essentials, but we don't practice civil disobedience prematurely. Now, in regard to COVID restrictions, some states require churches to close, claiming that the church was unessential, while grocery stores, hardware stores, and bars were deemed essential. And many churches responded by practicing civil disobedience and staying open. The Acts chapter 2 and Hebrews chapter 10 command for Christians to assemble trumps state authority, even over alleged health concerns. And historically, Christians have always practiced civil disobedience when the state forbids Christians to meet. Under the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, a law was passed making it illegal to influence people's minds by fear of the divinity, that it was detrimental to the psychological health of the people. This law was aimed to stamp out Christian evangelism. But the Christians ignored this law and practiced civil disobedience. By the way, keep in mind that historically, when the state persecutes the church, it rarely directly prohibits the gospel. But a pretext is used, such as the health and the safety of people. Christians rarely sit in jail or simply believe in the gospel. but for some other pretext. An evil state will gaslight the Christians. But back to this COVID situation. Even though the state may have been acting irrationally, the churches were still able to do much to accommodate to the law by meeting outside, by separating chairs, by following some of the same regulations given to grocery stores. Romans chapter 12, verse 18. If possible, so far as it depends upon you, be at peace with all men. And in Matthew chapter 5, verse 41, whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Roman law required citizens to carry backpacks of Roman soldiers 1 mile if a Roman soldier demanded it. The law may seem unfair and absurd, but Jesus said, don't just go 1 mile, go 2 miles. Now, what about Revelation chapter 13? The prophesied Antichrist provides that no one will be able to buy or sell unless one takes the mark of the beast. And every Christian knows that this is a taboo, because whoever takes of the mark of the beast will drink the wrath of God forever, Revelation 14. However, the biblical offense of such a law is not so easily discerned. For the government to require identification to buy or sell is not a moral sin. It may be unwise, it may be foolish, but it doesn't call for civil disobedience. So when the mark of the beast is implemented, you can be sure most people will have no problem with it. We already can't buy or sell unless we use government currency, have bank accounts, debit cards. So what's wrong with the mark of the beast? Well, the great sin is not in economic accountability, but in the requirement that participants must give their allegiance to the Antichrist and the Antichrist ideology of his empire. Just like early Christians refused to burn incense to Caesar and declare that Caesar is Lord, or as Christians in communist countries refuse to join the Communist Party because that means having to agree with atheistic communism. So civil disobedience is limited to the state requiring the Christian to do that which God clearly prohibits, or requiring the Christian to not do that which God clearly commands. Guideline number two, civil disobedience involves fleeing. As Jesus taught his disciples, Matthew chapter 10, but whenever they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. This fleeing can be applied in many different ways, physically leaving your country or your state, or leaving government schools because the gospel is rejected and persecuted there. And then the Christian is persecuted by having the extra financial burden of private education. Fleeing could mean leaving a certain job if the business promotes immorality. Fleeing could mean not shopping in certain stores. This doesn't mean we should completely disassociate ourselves from unbelievers. The fleeing Jesus was speaking about is when persecution endangers our lives or forces us to participate in evil. The point is to vote with your feet. And this puts extreme pressure on society and civil leaders, because one thing civil leaders can't afford is for the citizenship to walk. Imagine if all Christians snuck out of Germany before World War II, who would be left to support Hitler's unjust war? Now, in the early church, fleeing from persecution was very controversial. According to church history, Cyprian, the bishop of Carthage, about 240 AD, received much disapproval from the Christian community for leaving the city and his pastorate during a time of persecution. But Cyprian pointed to the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 10 that we are commanded by Christ to flee during times of persecution. But one can understand why some Christians would take offense to this, because some Christians might not have the resources to flee, and therefore they would be left to bear the persecution alone. They would lose the strength in numbers. And what if every Christian ran away every time the going got tough? An entire city, a country, a region of the world would be left in darkness. We are our brother's keeper. And unless someone stands up against evil, evil will continue to take over the world. Hiding and retreating can be seen as giving way to evil. Remember Gandalf in Tolkien's novels, "Thou shalt not pass"? Well, that's courage. That's taking a stand. But nevertheless, we need to consider the instructions of Jesus here and not merely resort to our own reasoning. Notice with this command to flee, Jesus gives an explanation. Again, Matthew 10:23, "But whenever they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. For truly I say to you, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes." Commentators believe that this is a reference to the cities of the world where the Jews live. And after the resurrection of Christ, the apostles went to the Jews first, to those cities that had synagogues. And by extension, this is also telling Gentile believers that we're not going to run out of cities to flee to before the second coming of Christ. Matthew 24:14, "The gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." And the point Jesus is making in Matthew chapter 10 is that the guiding principle is evangelism. There are 6 billion people on planet Earth that need the gospel, and if one group rejects the gospel and persecutes it, the gospel must go to others. The fleeing will not be a negative. It will actually help our evangelism. As in the book of Acts chapter 10, a great persecution broke out against the church in Jerusalem, and the believers were scattered abroad, but in this, they went about preaching the word. And this may soon happen in America. To get American Christians to leave their comfort zone and to go out into all the world for one final missionary endeavor. Jesus gave instructions. If you're not received in one city, wipe the dust off your feet as a witness against them and move on to the next city. And we see the apostles did this many times in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 13, when persecution broke out against Paul and his team in Pisidia, Antioch, they shook off the dust of their feet in protest against them, and went on to Iconium. So, fleeing is God's command to convict the unsaved, to disempower evil civil authorities, and to spread the gospel. Now, obviously, some flee out of cowardice rather than obedience to God, and some stay out of cowardice and worldliness rather than obedience to God. They place their priority on lands and goods and their family, not willing to forsake all for Christ. Here's a question. Should Christians leave leftist blue states and move to conservative red states? Well, what would best help the cause of missions? It's not those who are well who need a physician, but those who are sick. And we know God's plan is not for Christians to live in communes, apart from the unsaved. That never ends well. And consider this. The great prophets, Elijah and Elisha, who performed all of the miracles, were not in southern Israel, the more spiritual area, but God sent them to minister to pagan northern Israel, an area most people of faith would have given up on. So you want to have a ministry, and you want to see the power of God and the conversion of souls, consider moving to a gospel-dry area so that those who sit in darkness will see a great light. Guideline number 3, civil disobedience involves hiding. 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 4, "For when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water. Also, David hid from King Saul. Mary and Joseph hid from Herod by fleeing to Egypt until Herod died. John chapter 8, verse 59, "Therefore they picked up stones to throw at Jesus, But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. Isaiah 26:20. Come, my people, enter into your rooms and close your door behind you. Hide for a little while until indignation runs its course. The persecution of the Christians in the Roman Empire and throughout all church history was on again and off again, just depending on the ruler. God never lets persecutions go on for very long. As in Revelation chapter 2, the church of Smyrna, you will have tribulation for 10 days. God soon takes down evil leaders, so we're to hide while we wait. Principle number 4, civil disobedience involves withholding information. In John chapter 7, Jesus told his brothers that it wasn't his time to go up to the feast in Jerusalem. John 7:10, but when his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he himself also went up, not publicly, but as if in secret. That is withholding information. When the Pharisees refused to answer Jesus, Matthew 21, Jesus said, neither do I tell you by what authority do I do these things. Paul escaped the city of Damascus at night by being let down over the wall in a basket. This was withholding information from the city authorities about his departure. Notice that faith is not walking out the front gate, expecting God to blind the eyes of the authorities. God doesn't perform miracles to relieve men of their common sense or what they ought to be doing in the physical world. But what about lying? The old question of what if someone comes to your house at night and threatens you harm and asks if your family is home? Should you tell that person the truth? Or in Exodus chapter 1, the Hebrew midwives who refused to put to death the newborn Hebrew babies. The midwives told the authorities that the Jewish women gave birth before they got there, which may have been the truth. Since Christian people are of the truth, lying is abhorrent to the Christian. We don't want to be like Satan, the father of lies, or like Saul Alinsky in his Rules for Radicals, using deception to accomplish our ends. It's better to follow the scriptural pattern of withholding information. Everyone, even the state, doesn't have the right to know everything. Finally, principle number 5, biblical civil disobedience would only be the practice of passive disobedience. This is the way it's often described. Active civil disobedience would be the Boston Tea Party throwing tea into the harbor, the zealots in Jesus' day terrorizing the Romans, riots, obstructions, blocking doors. Passive disobedience would be refusing to obey or participate. Daniel chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego practiced passive disobedience by refusing to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol. Active civil disobedience would be to topple the idol. Now, sociologists and political activists debate over which is more effective, active or passive civil disobedience. Active civil disobedience is often very effective. What politicians fear the most is civil disruption, and they'll do almost anything to avoid it. But as I've tried to emphasize in all of these sessions, we should not be guided by utilitarianism or pragmatism, what happens to work, but by the Word of God. Jesus left us an example. 1 Peter chapter 2. For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously, God the Father. Now, the question of abortion comes up in regard to passive versus active civil disobedience. Because there are some biblical examples of active civil disobedience, as in the case of Gideon destroying the altar of Baal. But that is the role of the lesser magistrate, and we'll discuss that in our next session. But consider Proverbs 24, which instructs us to deliver those who are being taken away to death to hold them back. And that sounds very much like a command to some sort of action to prevent the slaughter of the innocent. And for this reason, protests against abortion in our country have been greater than protests against any other moral issue in our nation. Since the preservation of life is high up on God's hierarchy of authority, there does need to be some sort of active civil disobedience to stop abortion. But an active civil disobedience that includes no violence, such as the creation of crisis pregnancy centers, sidewalk counseling, lobbying the government to hold back and deliver those who are being taken away to death. In conclusion, what is really behind civil disobedience? Why has God allowed for unjust rulers so that we have to practice civil disobedience? Well, it's ordained of God to test our loyalty and allegiance to God. An opportunity to put God before man, before the state, before our property and our well-being. As in Luther's hymn, "Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also. The body they may kill, God's truth abideth still. His kingdom is forever." Civil disobedience is a test of our faith. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 7. "So the proof of your faith being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." May Jesus Christ reign.